From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's been a whirlwind year in politics, from New York City's fiercely contested mayoral race to high-profile policy battles at the state capitol, and across the border in Pennsylvania, election officials tackled administrative hurdles and public trust challenges. Today, we'll hear from the New York Public News Network's reporters on some of the 2025 headlines.
It was an extremely emotional debate over this legislation. It was one of the most emotional that I've seen in recent years. You had lawmakers that were crying.
And we'll speak to VoteBeat PA's Carter Walker.
This is a county that uses equipment where you make selections for who you want to vote for on the touch screen, and then the machine prints you out a ballot. And so they didn't have enough paper in a lot of those precincts.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he expects to meet with President Trump on Sunday. The talks will be aimed at ending the war in Ukraine. NPR's Joanna Gakissis reports Russia is examining the latest version of a peace proposal negotiated by the U.S. and Ukraine.
Zelensky wrote on social media that, quote, a lot can be decided before the new year. Territorial issues remain the most sensitive. Earlier this week, Zelensky said he was open to withdrawing Ukrainian troops from the eastern region of Donbas, as long as Russia also pulled back its troops. Ukraine controls about a quarter of this region. The Trump administration is proposing turning this portion into a free economic zone. Volodymyr Polovyi, a soldier whose unit is stationed in Donbas, says Russia has been trying to occupy the region for more than a decade. And during that time, he says, Russia signed peace and ceasefire agreements and did not respect them. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
U.S. forces have launched a strike against Islamic State fighters in northwest Nigeria. NPR's Scott Newman reports President Trump made the announcement last night on social media.
Writing on Truth Social, Trump suggested that the attack on ISIS militants was in response to, quote, targeting and viciously killing of Christians in the country's northwest. The Pentagon confirmed the strike, which it said was carried out in Sokoto State at the request of Nigerian authorities. Trump has accused Nigeria of failing to stop the persecution of Christians in the country, and last month he said he ordered the Pentagon to draw up plans for possible military action against ISIS there. Nigeria is roughly evenly divided between Christians and Muslims. The country's government says attacks by militant groups are less about religion and more about where the groups operate. In his post, Trump wished a, quote, Merry Christmas to all, including the dead terrorists. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
A powerful storm system that brought days of heavy rain, wind, and snow to California is starting to ease. But as Steve Futterman reports, a number of trouble spots remain across the state.
The latest storms are not expected to be as powerful as the storms the last 2 days. Those have caused extensive damage. Many roads have been turned into a muddy mess. There have also been numerous rock slides and debris flows. A number of water rescues have taken place, and several deaths have been reported. By this Sunday, this current series of storms will have passed, but it could be just a brief respite. The forecast calls for more rain next week on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
Steve Futterman reporting from Los Angeles. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 48 points. This is NPR. A grizzly bear was seen this week in a southwest Montana mountain range that hasn't seen bears for more than 50 years. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Doolin reports the sighting comes as lawmakers consider removing the bear's federal protections.
State wildlife officials confirmed the bear sighting in mountains roughly 100 miles from Yellowstone National Park, the first time a grizzly's been spotted there since bear recovery began in the 1970s. The regions around Yellowstone and Glacier National Park support the two largest populations of bears in Montana. As their numbers grow, the bears are seeking out new habitat in their historic ranges. Congress is currently considering legislation to take these bears off the endangered species list. Montana and Wyoming state officials say this population has sufficiently recovered and are requesting grizzlies be delisted. U.S. Fish and Wildlife last January rejected states' petitions to delist bears in the lower 48. For NPR News, I'm Ellis Ju Lin in Missoula, Montana.
Hawaii's Big Island is banning people from feeding feral cats. It's a move officials say is needed to protect native wildlife. The law is set to take effect in January and allows fines of up to $50 for a first offense, increasing to $500 for repeat violations. Biologists argue the ban is necessary to protect native species from both cat attacks and parasites carried in cat feces. But critics of the ban warn it could push feeding efforts underground and leave hungry cats hunting more, not less. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 33 points, the S&P up a fraction. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're taking a look back at politics on both sides of the river in New York and Pennsylvania. First up, New York, where it's been quite the eventful year, from a fiercely contested New York City mayor's race to high-profile policy debates and a last-minute state budget showdown at the Capitol in Albany. From the New York Public News Network, WMHT's Chantel Destra takes a closer look at the headlines that shaped 2025 and is joined by Politico's Caitlin Cordero, Bloomberg's Raga Justin, and Jimmy Vielkind of WNYC, Gothamist, and the New York Public News Network.
Thank you all so much for joining us today. We're so excited to recap the year in New York State politics.
Thank you. Happy to see you.
Thanks for having us.
And we know it's been quite a busy year in New York State politics, but naturally I wanted to start things off with the legislative session that took place in the early part of the year. What are some of your biggest policy takeaways and moments from reporting at the state capitol this year?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me is that once again, Governor Hochul has shown her tactic and her approach to the session is to just let the budget go late, to put all the items that she wishes to address into the state budget, which this year rose to more than $250 billion, trillion with a T, dollars of spending, and to essentially hold that over lawmakers, Democrats, people in her own party who control both the state assembly and the state senate, until she gets what she wants. So this year, the budget was not adopted until early May. It was more than a full 30 days past that March 31 deadline. And Hochul seems to be very comfortable with this tactic, very comfortable with using it. And I think part of the effect of that is to freeze out other action in the legislative session. Normally, there's sort of two peaks in a legislative session, one around the budget in that March, late March time, and then one toward the end of June or in June when the session ends. And by kind of extending budget season over time, Hochul kept herself in a firm driver's seat on the process and really, I think, choked out other bills that may or may not have popped forward.
I think this session was also overshadowed by the threat of federal funding cuts, right? There was a big funding showdown between the Trump administration and New York as a blue state, I think, bore the brunt of that in a lot of ways. And so you saw a lot of angst from the governor and from, Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie and Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins around these projected losses. And so they're trying to position themselves, I think, this past year as a bulwark against the Trump administration. But there's also a lot of uncertainty around how are we going to backfill these losses that are going to impact New Yorkers and everything from healthcare to food stamps. So I think that, again, that kind of shadowed, it felt like to me, a lot of the policies that were coming out. It sort of tempered otherwise strong policies. And maybe sometimes it spurred especially more progressive lawmakers to say, at least, even if nothing actually ended up happening, we got to take a stronger stance against the federal government here.
And I want to go back to the budget, Jimmy. I'm glad you mentioned that because that was very interesting to me. I think at the start of the year, it seemed like the executive leadership and legislative leaders said, you know, we were all rowing in the same direction when it came to addressing affordability. But of course, things took a dramatic turn over some policy items, as you mentioned, discovery reform, involuntary commitment, the cell phone bans in schools, and mask bans across the state. So is there any possibility that you think these items might come back next year?
Well, what we have seen in the past few years from Governor Hochul is a desire to take actions that she believes will increase either the perception of public safety or that will sort of roll back some of the changes to the state's criminal justice laws and criminal justice procedures that were enacted in the first flash of Democratic majorities in 2019, 2020, and to some extent into 2021. So that includes things like changes to the state's bail laws, you know, reductions and limiting really the instances in which money can be used to keep a person behind bars before their trial. There are also now some talk about an older criminal justice change, which is the age of criminal responsibility at which juveniles are treated as adults. So Hochul has been very clear that her twin pillars are affordability and public safety. And her public safety fights have come in the budget because she has leverage, and they have basically held everything up. As you pointed out, Chantel, this year it was with regard to discovery, which is the exchange of evidence before a criminal trial. And so I think it's possible we'll see something like that again, but I'm also cognizant that this is a different year because it's a re-election year. We do know that Democrats are in control of both houses of the legislature. Hochul is, of course, also a Democrat. And the Democrats in the legislature tend to have a more progressive bent than what we've seen from Hochul, who's really a moderate governor. So to the extent, we will have to see the extent to which she wants to have conflict and to have another fight on these issues in an election year.
And Caitlin, I know that you've been doing a lot of awesome reporting around medical aid and dying. Now, we know this is a very controversial policy initiative that advocates have been trying to get passed and, you know, put over the finish line for over a decade. It was a very historic moment when it passed through the legislature this year. And we saw Governor Kathy Hochul this week say that she intended to sign the legislation. So what can you tell us about these developments and how things sort of progressed through the session?
Yes, so this was something that has been going on for more than a decade. We've seen these advocates, they line the halls in the Capitol, you know, imploring lawmakers to come, you know, to sign on to the bill and to show their support. So this is a unique situation where you didn't have Democrats, you know, all in line and in step. You know, it was an extremely emotional debate over this legislation. It was one of the most emotional that I've seen in, you know, in recent years. You had lawmakers that were crying, talking about this because they had to contend with their personal moral beliefs and their religious beliefs and, you know, with what their constituents want or what they think is right. So it was a very tough debate. And yesterday we did see, this week we saw the governor talking about how she also had to overcome her religious upbringing. She's a Catholic, and this is something that the Catholic Church is vehemently against. And we saw their comments came out, very staunch opposition. They're very upset with the governor now. It is puts her in a tough situation where she's always had very good working relationships with, you know, religious leaders in the state. And this is putting her against them on an issue that they really see as, you know, there's nothing short of a veto would be anything but acceptable to them. They negotiated an agreement. Jimmy, you know, got some of those details out earlier this month, and they finally came to some amendments that are, you know, may not be what the advocates wanted, and some of these amendments they pushed against during the legislative session when they were negotiating the details, but some of them were added back in. And also, some of them are things that we haven't seen in other states that have this, like a video or audio request, which is something that was a bit of a surprise. That's not something that we heard from lawmakers when they were having negotiations and talking about the legislation. So this is, you know, it's very,
it's got higher safeguards than we've seen in any other state. But, you know, they haven't passed it yet. There is still time. They have the governor is promising to sign it, but the official language hasn't come out yet. That's going to be introduced in January. And then the legislature will have to pass the chapter amendments, and then it will go back to Hochul to sign.
You know, Caitlin, you were so right to underline sort of the emotional nature of this debate. And I think what thing that's stood out to me about this topic is that so often the things that are discussed and debated in the state legislature are so abstract. Right? We're talking about discovery reform, about what evidence before a trial. You know, it takes 30 seconds just to even explain what you're talking about. This is so tangible for people. Most people have unfortunately had to grapple with the end of the life of a person that they love, and they've seen this, and they can put themselves in this situation. And so watching our lawmakers wrestle with that in real time, I thought was quite poignant and quite interesting. I think you're absolutely right that it was really interesting. And it will be interesting that we're going to have to, as you just pointed out, we're going to have to do it again in January with the vote on these amendments.
Absolutely. Are there any other controversial bills that are on the docket for the governor that you all are looking out for?
I personally am looking at the RAISE Act. I think that's a pretty, you know, it doesn't get a ton of attention because it is quite difficult to explain the intricacies of artificial intelligence. I mean, I don't understand it, honestly, at all. And yet we still are supposed to be writing about these bills that are really highly technical and deal with really highly technical industries. But I think its stated intent is to place, you know, we were talking about safeguards. This is an attempt to place the nation's strongest safeguards on artificial intelligence developers and to basically hold those companies, very large companies, what we would think of as big tech, to hold them accountable for the potential risks and consequences that could come from very large AI models. And there's been a lot of back and forth between the governor and the bill sponsor on that. As of now, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's really interesting to talk to people who are invested in this issue, AI safety advocates, and also big tech representatives themselves, because everyone is watching the governor on this and everyone's watching New York on this. There's a lot of federal interest in stopping states from regulating AI, artificial intelligence. And, you know, there's a lot of different theories as to why that's the case. I think Silicon Valley has been showing up and showing out in D.C. And so if you're an AI safety advocate or a progressive, let's say, lawmaker, although it's a bipartisan issue, a state lawmaker, you want your own state to be putting some sort of restrictions in the absence of federal policy on this issue. And so I think, you know, California already has a version of the RAISE Act. New York could follow, and it could either go out in front of California and say, we are going to be the strongest in the country, or it could decide to be on par with California. Or the third option is that the governor could choose to veto the bill entirely and sort of, you know, leave it up to either next session or to the federal government to do something here. So a lot of interest in this from the tech industry and I think probably just like consumer safety, you know, and protection advocates as well.
One bill I'm looking for is an omnibus prison reform bill, which was passed in June. And really, it's been quite a year for New York's prison system, starting actually in 2024 with the beating death of Robert Brooks, who is a person incarcerated at the Marcy Correctional Facility outside of Utica. 10 prison employees were charged in connection with his death. At least one was convicted of murder. And as this was unfolding, it really brought to the fore years of abuse and years of mistreatment of incarcerated people at the hands of correctional officers and guards. And this was really in the wake of this horrific incident, which was caught on a body camera, and the footage was just really jarring to see. This was going to be the year of big reform for legislators. But that sort of got deflated a little bit, and the narrative shifted in February when corrections officers went on a wildcat strike and shut down the prison system, complaining about staffing and complaining about policies that they say have contributed to a rise in violence, chief among them the HALT Act, which restricts the amount of time an incarcerated person can be placed into solitary confinement. And so prison issues are not always top of mind in Albany, but they really were this session. And in that miasma emerged this package of reforms, which was drawn from a number of bills that had been put forward by advocates and had really been in the purview of State Senator Julia Salazar, a Democrat from Brooklyn, who chairs the Corrections Committee in her chamber. This package would do a number of things. It would require more fixed cameras within state prisons. It would change the oversight body, the State Commission on Correction, which is tasked with overseeing correctional facilities. And it's been up in the air as to what Governor Hochul is going to do. As Raga said, and as Caitlin perfectly explained earlier, right, the governor likes to do these chapter amendments where a bill passes and then she kind of negotiates her changes and says, if you do these amendments, you can win my signature, which is something that lawmakers complain about, but it seems to be the process that we're living through here. And so it's an open question as to what changes Governor Hochul is going to seek on this omnibus prison oversight bill and whether or not they will be acceptable to sponsors. So that's one of the big pieces of legislation that is coming to a conclusion in these final days of 2025. And perhaps it's something we're going to be talking more about in 2026.
And I want to switch gears a little bit and look at the, of course, competitive race for the next New York City mayor that took place earlier this year. You know, we saw so many different candidates, but ultimately Assemblymember Zohran Mamdani was victorious in that race, and he is now the mayor-elect. So what can you tell us about that race? Why was it so competitive? And, you know, what will the inroads be for the Assemblymember into Albany come next year?
Well, good for Zohran Mamdani. He went from being a backbench assembly member to, you know, leader of easily the greatest city in the world. And, you know, I'm older than him, so it makes my mother ask what I'm doing, why I'm not leading a major world metropolis. So thank you, Zohran. We appreciate that. I think this race is really interesting because there have been so many persistent gripes about New York City. Coming out of the pandemic, there were real challenges with public safety, and that really defined the 2021 mayoral election. Eric Adams, a former police officer and a former state senator, he rose to the fore by essentially betting that delivering on a message of reducing crime, helping and bolstering the public perception of public safety would win him City Hall, and he was correct. This time around, you saw Mamdani face off against a political scion, Andrew Cuomo, this titanic figure in New York State and city politics, who has been active in New York City politics for literally 50 years, five decades. And so this idea of sort of a David and Goliath, a young versus old, and Mamdani's message of affordability, of focusing on cost of living, on proposing things that he hopes will help people in New York City tackle that rising cost of living and that difficulty of living in the five boroughs. That's what made this race so resonant. And that's why I think it has some kind of deeper meaning for Democrats across the country, wondering what direction the party can take, what the party message should be, and what can boost forward, can boost them forward in 2026 and beyond.
Yeah, I think he, you know, you saw that he had a sense of what people are looking for when he was on the campaign trail. And we talk a lot about the, you know, kitchen table issues. And that's what he focused in on, affordability. He talked about, you know, mental health and how, you know, looking to have, you know, de-escalation by not including police in some of these, you know, if you have someone that's struggling with mental health, if it's not necessary to bring in the NYPD or bring in a social worker instead and creating a new system there. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of these issues that people have been talking about and have been front of mind that I know I hear from my family at the kitchen table. And he's been able to work with that and show that, you know, appeal to New Yorkers to say that I'm going to fix these issues that you have been talking about for years and saying that New York is, you know, it's impossible to live in New York on a reasonable salary and talking about addressing that. That's what most New Yorkers want and that's what they want to hear.
I thought there was a really interesting dynamic here also with, I think, Jimmy, you sort of referenced this, a new energy, this idea of cleaning out the old and bringing in the new. I mean, he's young. He's in his early 30s. He was up against a man who was a couple of generations older than him. And part of, I think, what his campaign focused on was this idea of revitalization, of breathing new life into an established political machine and taking down an established political dynasty. And you saw young people get really excited about that, especially in New York City. I mean, even upstate, which is funny because, you know, people that I know upstate who are sort of my age or in Mamdani's generation, they couldn't vote for him, but they were talking about it like it meant something for the generation that he is a part of and people younger than him as well. And I'm personally interested to see maybe how that translates into the next cycle of races. I think there's already a lot of interest in, you know, leftist challengers to incumbent Democrats, specifically in the Democratic Party. And a lot of them tend to be younger. A lot of them tend to be outside of the establishment. And they're using that. They're using their age and their, you know, some people might call it relative inexperience, but others might call it the breath of fresh air approach to try to make the case for why there needs to be kind of a wholesale clean out of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, he also did a great job harnessing new media, harnessing social media, short vertical form videos. You know, the candidates who get on these cutting edge tactics, be it John F. Kennedy and this crazy thing called television in 1960, or Zoran Mamdani on the TikTok in 2025, you have the advantage, especially over, again, a person like Andrew Cuomo, who is not on the cutting edge of technology. The other thing that I think is really fascinating is that Mamdani will be New York City's first Muslim mayor and its first mayor of South Asian descent. And he tapped into this sort of ever-changing demographic profile of New York City, right? It was a big deal when there was the first Italian mayor and the first Irish mayor and the first Jewish mayor. And now we're seeing yet another new demographic, new people who have made their home in New York City, seeing someone with whom they can identify take power in City Hall. And I think the fact that he did that and sort of fractured these old ethnic political calculuses, that's, I don't think the right way to make that plural, but he fractured that, I think that is also noteworthy and is going to make people rethink what it means to run for office in New York City and in New York State. Yeah,
so well said. I think the campaign by the assembly member was the definition of a grassroots campaign. We saw people come out and canvass for the assembly member. I believe he had over, you know, a crazy amount of people working on the ground, door knocking and, you know, pushing his policies forward. And I'm interested to see next year how the governor is going to be working with the mayor, especially since it'll be her gubernatorial reelection. So last election cycle for the governor, we saw Representative Lee Zeldin come within, I believe, 6 points of unseating the governor. And it's looking like next year's race is going to be equally as competitive. So what is the governor's political positioning heading into next year as she is going to be running for re-election, but also handling the regular business of the legislative session?
I think this, you know, you typically see a pretty boring budget when going into an election year, to not stir the pot too much. But she does have the challenge of federal cuts that are coming in, and cuts to Medicaid and difficult decisions regarding insurance coverage and individuals that are being kicked off the state's essential plan, which is a low-cost health insurance plan. She's going to have tough decisions to make, some of these cuts are years down the line. They're going to be more, they're going to be harsher further down. So she does have a little bit of time where if she wants to push some of these hard, hard decisions that can come after the election, and we may see some of that. But it is a tough year where you have the federal government that is targeting states like New York, you know, to cut back on the federal funding because their politics and the policies are so far against New York. So it's a tough, you know, she's going to have a tough position. I wouldn't want to be in her position.
I think also I'm wondering if there are going to be some policies or some sort of package around immigration protections. You know, we mentioned politics entering the chat with the Trump administration. And I think like the topic of immigration is a very deeply political one, but it's also something that I would assume the mayor of New York City, I think he's spoken, about his own affiliation with the immigrant community and his desire to protect them from federal immigration enforcement activity, which we've already seen happening. I mean, New York City has been a hotbed of ICE activity over the past couple of months. And so, you know, I think that is sort of a minefield waiting to happen. And I think the governor is going to have to at least message that she is doing something on it. I'm not sure exactly what that looks like. And I'm not sure exactly how much we see it happen before November 2026. But I would think that is going to be a topic of concern for sure.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on both of those fronts, both on the fiscal side and on policies, especially including immigration. Hochul is going to face pressure to tack to the left. She faces a Democratic primary challenge right now from Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado. Polls show he's not getting a ton of traction, but he, coupled with Mamdani's win and that energy we were talking about, I think is going to pull Hochul to do and enact some of these progressive policies that she might not otherwise want to. And so I expect the tension in these months coming up to the election will be kind of how far to the left does she go, and how much ammunition does that give to a prospective Republican challenger? I think both Caitlin and Raga were right. These are going to be the areas to watch.
Yeah, so much to watch here, but unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for your awesome reporting.
Thanks, Chantel.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And we were speaking with Caitlin Cordoro of Politico, Raga Justin of Bloomberg, and Jimmy Vailkind of WNYC, Gothamist, and the New York Public News Network.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Vote Beat PA's Carter Walker on what 2025 revealed about Pennsylvania's elections. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar, host of Farming Country. This week, we're joined by a special guest from our Farming Country family.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr. This week, we're sharing our well-loved top picks from 2025, from the Sweet and Spicy Pepper Fest in Damascus, Pennsylvania,
to the Junior Master Gardeners Program at Western Sullivan Public Library. That's this week on Farming Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As Pennsylvania closes the books on 2025, election officials faced a year defined by administrative challenges, staff turnover, and lingering questions about public trust. From ongoing operational issues in Luzerne County to misprinted poll books affecting tens of thousands of voters in Chester County, the state's elections ran smoothly overall, but not without hiccups. Reporter Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA and Spotlight PA spoke with Jason Dole about this year's key stories and what they reveal about the state of democracy in Pennsylvania.
Well, Carter Walker, welcome back to Radio Catskill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I do want to talk about, you know, what stood out to you in the year that was 2025 in terms of elections in Pennsylvania, and which is your beat at VoteBeat and at Spotlight PA. But I want to start with your most recent article, which in some ways is also a recap of what's been going on the past few years, because you did a deep dive into Luzerne County, which seems to keep having election problems.
Yeah, that's right. Your listeners, and you might remember Luzerne County, it got a lot of attention after the 2022 midterm elections. About a third of the precincts in the county had ran out of the ballot paper that they needed to run their elections. This is a county that uses equipment where you make selections for who you want to vote for on the touch screen, and then the machine prints you out a ballot. And so they didn't have enough paper in a lot of those precincts. It was a real big debacle. Congress, U.S. Congress, ended up holding a hearing on the problem. The district attorney investigated. The problem, it was determined, was, okay, you know, we just had so much turnover in this department that nobody really knew what the right steps were to take, which, you know, is an unfortunately common story, I think, when you have a lot of turnover in a department. But we've kept an eye on the county the past couple of years. And leadership there has somewhat stabilized. They now have an election director who's been, you know, in the field for at least one full cycle of elections. And by that, I mean a four-year term, you know, through the presidential and the midterms and the local elections. But, you know, issues can seem to be just continuing to happen. And the reporting that we did was to point out, hey, this is still going on, and what is the reason for that? One, I think, plausible explanation we got from the county council chairman there is just that, well, you know, because Luzerne has garnered this bad reputation with some of the mistakes of its past, we get a little bit more scrutiny than other counties do. You know, in some counties, maybe these issues would have flown under the radar and not been reported, and it was, you know, just something that happened and they dealt with. But because of Luzerne's past, it might get outsized attention.
Okay, well, that sounds like an idea, but, you know, you're the right person to ask about that. As you look at, you know, problems that are happening, are the problems that are popping up for Luzerne County, are they the sorts of things that would ordinarily fly under the radar, in your opinion?
I think there are some that, you know, if it didn't have the same media attention, might not, you know, be reported. There's one where it's a little unclear to me because the county didn't really answer my questions on what happened, but it's a little unclear on whether these items that are needed to run the polls were not in the bags that were given to poll workers ahead of Election Day, or if they were just if the bag wasn't organized properly so some of the poll workers couldn't find that item. You know, things go missing at polling places. These bags worth of equipment, bags filled with equipment, aren't always, I don't know, intuitively put together, or sometimes somebody picks up the wrong bag for a different precinct. I've seen that stuff happen in counties and not make it into the news. But, you know, then there's other errors that happened that definitely a big problem, definitely have been covered no matter where they are. Like Luzerne County had a ballot question on the ballot this year about whether or not they wanted to change their government structure for the county government. That was improperly worded. It wasn't written down the way it should have been. So they had to reissue some ballots because of that. There's been candidates' names misspelled, obviously a problem. So, yeah, I'd say it's kind of a mix of both.
It occurs to me that the moment that we live in politics is where there's a lot of suspicion of elections, and maybe we should disclaim that none of these problems that you're talking about rise to the level of voter fraud or something that impacted in a major way the outcome of any elections, correct?
No, and yes, thank you. I think about these things in such like an administrative procedural sense sometimes that I forget that that's an important point to make. But, you know, these issues that we're talking about, there are things getting discovered pretty much before the election day happens or in the post-election period when they're checking things to make sure everything went okay. And, you know, that's ideally when you want those things to be caught if there is an issue so that doesn't affect the end results. And the good news is here the county is detecting these things and is making sure they don't impact the outcome of the election. Like, for example, one of the items in the story that we lead off the story with is about 31 male voters because of either a mistake that Luzerne made or perhaps a mistake with the state's computer system. It's a little unclear why, but 31 male voters were issued a second mail ballot and the county canceled those second ballots so that, you know, those voters couldn't vote twice. But even if they had gotten both ballots, they wouldn't have been able to vote twice because of how when the votes get recorded in the state system, it would block a second vote from being recorded for that person. So, yeah, that's an important point to make.
So there's a number of these small problems that have been popping up over time in Luzerne County. We've explored the idea that, you know, maybe Luzerne County, because of past problems, getting a little more scrutiny than perhaps other counties are, at least from the media end. But your reporting also looks into the aspect of there possibly being a structural problem in terms of Luzerne County's elections.
Yes, the county, unlike most counties in the state, I think there's only 8 that do it this way, something like that, a very low number. They've adopted a home rule structure of government, which means that instead of following what our state law says on this is how you organize a county government, this is the offices and who's responsible for what, the county's voters opted to design their own structure of government. And the important part here for elections is that the county has an elections board, but it's comprised of people appointed by the elected officials, the county council, and the both of them have a little bit of oversight over to the department. County council, you know, finances, hiring, because it's, you know, an executive type office. And then the Board of Elections, you know, they make decisions over things like, okay, should we count these provisional ballots? Do we put drop boxes in X or Y municipality? So they both have a little bit of responsibility over how elections get run in the county, you know, which has been pointed out to me is probably a stressor for the people who work in elections, you know, more or less having to answer to two bosses. Even the county council member who I spoke with for the story, he said, yeah, you know, that's probably a stress on the department. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly does that structure lead to problems, but it seems pretty intuitive that it would be, you know, make it more difficult for the people in that office or leading that office to deal with.
You know, there's so many times that I've spoken with you about various voting issues in Pennsylvania, and the question that I often come back to is, okay, what's the solution, and is there a legislative solution? What's the legislature doing? But you just brought up this notion of like a home rule county in terms of how they're executing their elections. Well, that raises a question for me. Like, even if legislators drew a comb through some regulations and made things clear for counties, that might not help in Luzerne County's case?
Right. Yeah. You know, to clear up the responsibilities, that would definitely be something the county has to do itself. And they did have the ballot question that I was referencing that got misworded was to do with how the home rule structure works, but it wasn't successful in passing. That might have made a little bit of changes to the elections, but in any event, didn't pass. I think it's important to note that the election director has now been there for several years, and we haven't the issues that we cite in our story. While some of them, you know, there are things I don't want to say aren't serious issues. You know, misspelling a candidate's name is of course not a good thing, but they're not of the same catastrophic type of caliber that we saw in 2022. Another change the county has made, you know, one judge of elections, a local poll worker that I spoke with, he said, you know, a lot of the judges, we think the problem is with the types of voting equipment that the county uses and the fact that the vendor that they had programming those machines was often the one being blamed for the problems that were arising. Now they're switching to a different election method. They're going to use paper ballots instead of a machine that would print you out a paper ballot. They're just going to move to straight paper. And he thinks some of that will help. So they're making some changes still. And the state has implemented a training program for new directors trying to avoid some of these issues like Luzerne had in 2022. And I've heard good reviews on that. I don't know if any of the staff at the Luzerne County Elections Office went through that training, but that is something the state's been trying to do to help with the turnover problem.
We're talking to Carter Walker, Vote Beat PA, and work is also up at Spotlight PA, and we're kind of doing our year in review and a look ahead in terms of Pennsylvania elections. But we started with Carter's most recent story there about Luzerne County and some of the problems there. But I mean, Carter, as we look back on the year that was, you also mentioned Chester County as a county that stands out as being something to talk about.
Yeah, Chester County, they, as we're talking about, you know, problems with election administration, they had by far the worst, unfortunately, by far the worst problem this year, which was the poll books that they use to check voters into precincts. You know, this is the big book that when you walk into your precinct, you sign it, and then the poll worker gives you your ballot. Those poll books were misprinted, so they didn't include the independent or third-party voters, which is about 75,000 voters in Chester County. as a result of that, those voters, they either had to wait and come back later in the day when supplemental poll books could be printed and then vote a regular ballot or vote a provisional ballot, which can be a little risky because there are things that can get your provisional ballot disqualified that don't necessarily have to do with whether or not you're a registered and eligible voter. So the county is still investigating to see exactly what the cause of that misprint was. In fact, their investigation is supposed to wrap up today. They hired an outside firm that's supposed to deliver their results to the county today, but the public is still not going to see those results until sometime in January. I want to give a shout out to Philadelphia Inquirer. They had some good reporting earlier this week on this issue where they found that there had been a really high rate of turnover in the elections office that stemmed from what they termed as a toxic work environment, possibly some issues with the management in the department. So I think that was some good reporting and helps contextualize the issue as well. Because, you know, as we're talking about more turnover, and this is, I know this from a story we did back in 2023, more turnover in general is going to lead to more problems. You know, that seems pretty intuitive, but we were able to look at the numbers of turnover in the state and the amount of ballot errors. And there's a correlation there. You know, obviously, if you lose people who know what it is that they're doing, you lose that institutional knowledge, and then it just makes errors more prevalent.
I seem to recall reporting within the last couple of years, this is a problem across the country. There's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of shakeup. There's a lot of people with many years of experience leaving the election infrastructure in states around the country. Is that a correct thing to be thinking, or am I misremembering this?
Nope, absolutely right. You know, we did a story on that last year. I can't remember the figures off the top of my head, but we were down a couple of hundred years worth of experience going into the 2024 election versus the 2020 election. You know, that trend is the same across the entire country from what I've seen from some, you know, think tank or policy type institutes that have studied this. And I mean, yeah, it is a problem, obviously not having folks that remember how things were done the last time increases the chance you might make an error. I believe it's been getting a little bit better, really in 2020 and 2021 and 2022. That's when you saw the bulk of people leaving. And it was due to a lot of things, COVID probably, no doubt, but also the backlash election administrators faced after the 2020 election. And, you know, the false narratives about them working to steal or manipulate the elections. I remember one election administrator I knew, when I asked him why he left, and he left sometime in 2021, he told me it just wasn't fun anymore. And this was a job he really liked. He enjoyed it. He did it for many years. And you find that election directors, they really do tend to enjoy the work. But, you know, they started getting harassment. Nobody trusted them anymore. Some cases they were getting death threats, and it wasn't fun anymore. Thankfully, I do think that trend is abating a little bit. They seem to be sticking around a little bit more. So hopefully that will settle down.
Well, it's good to hear that aspect is improving. That trend is reversing a little, because bigger picture, the kind of dark election moment and the false narratives of the 2020 election, that they are casting a long shadow that actually do impact our look back on elections in Pennsylvania in 2025, especially because a lot of the folks that were pushing those false narratives, well, they're now in charge of the administration that's running our federal government. Can you talk about any ways where you know, the fallout from the 2020 election is still impacting us now?
Yeah, I would say you're definitely right. I mean, there's people who pushed or fully believed that the election was manipulated or stolen that are now in positions of power in the federal government. I think one of the things that I'm most concerned about, and I know there has been some polling that would suggest probably the opposite of this after the 2024 election. You know, I remember seeing some polling that conservatives were much more trustworthy of elections then. But my sense is that, okay, well, now there is some faction, not just of conservatives, but some faction of the population readily primed to believe there is manipulation going on in our elections or to distrust election administration in general. And, you know, after the 2024 election, we saw it popping up on the left as well, individuals and groups coming out, making a lot of very, very similar, if not the same claims as groups on the right had after the 2024 election. You know, the difference being that those claims weren't amplified by leadership in the Democratic Party or allies on the left. But still concerning to me that the Overton window seems to have shifted at least a little bit to where those arguments, those conspiracy theories are now much more acceptable.
Yeah, they get more traction in many different areas. I'm glad you just brought that up, because I wanted to ask you that question towards the end, you know, about seeing that post the 2024 election. I know that I was seeing what you described there, but could you just talk a little bit more about that? As a reporter reporting on elections, were you getting that sort of conspiratorial thinking from readers and people approaching you, you know, especially from Democrats or people ostensibly on the left or non-MAGA people? Was that part of your 2025? Were you hearing that directly?
Yeah, definitely. I had some messages in my inbox that really reminded me of 2021, saying, oh, you know, election's rigged, Kamala didn't lose, that kind of thing. I mean, it's hard to remember now if it was more or less than I got in 2020. I think culturally overall it was less. It didn't get as much amplification as those claims on the right did in 2021, you know, or 2020. I'm certainly comfortable saying that, but no doubt it's there. And, you know, my question going into the years ahead is, again, is that a moment that we live through in American history, or is that now a facet of elections that we're going to deal with in each post-election period going forward?
We're talking to Carter Walker, VoteBeat PA. Let's talk about the impact of the federal government in 2025 on elections. Where do things stand now? What were you following this year with a new administration in Washington that seems very interested in how elections are being run?
Right. Obviously, you know, election administration, since Trump feels that he lost or had the 2020 election stolen from him, obviously we knew, I think, going into this administration that that was going to be a big focus with him. And I think we saw that play out this past year. It started in the spring when the Department of Justice started reaching out to states, asking them for information from their voter rolls, and that eventually snowballed into the department suing several states. The count is somewhere in the teens now for copies of their voter rolls, which might not strike folks as that much of an issue. I have several copies of our voter rolls in my computer right now, but what the Department of Justice is asking for is the non-public version of the state's voter rolls, which include driver's licenses and Social Security numbers. And a lot of states, like Pennsylvania, have prohibitions. In fact, ours is in our state constitution against handing out that type of personal information. And traditionally, the department or the federal government has not sought to gather that level of detailed personal information on citizens. And there's a specific process through which they're supposed to go if they want to do that, which many folks were pointing out, they were kind of circumventing. And so now that's all wrapped up in the courts. Many states, Pennsylvania included, are refusing to hand over those non-public versions of the voter rolls, and the Department of Justice is fighting them. We are still waiting to see how that plays out. It's gotten wrapped up in the courts and was delayed a little bit with the government shutdown, but it's still moving forward. The other thing we saw is Trump issuing an executive order on elections and election administration. It did several things. Probably focus on three. First, it sought to change a federal voter registration form to include a requirement for proof of citizenship. It also directed a federal agency to change the certification on voting machines so as not to allow voting machines that used a QR code to read voters' selections on a ballot. And the third thing it did was it said that states, it directed states not to accept ballots that arrive after Election Day, which Pennsylvania doesn't do that with its mail ballots, but there are about 18 states that do allow ballots that arrive after Election Day to be counted if they are postmarked as being sent before Election Day. Now, you know, all election administration issues that reasonable folks can debate whether or not that should be the policy, sure. But the issue was that the U.S. Constitution, it doesn't grant the president authority over how elections are run. It says that that authority is with the states, and Congress can make laws on election administration if it chooses, but it doesn't give the president the authority to do those things through executive order. So, you know, the parts that, where he is directing his federal agencies to do certain things, you know, that's a conversation between him and the federal agencies. I haven't seen many states moving to amend their laws on late arriving mail ballots, though I'm not paying as close attention to them as Pennsylvania, which doesn't do that. There were a number of states that sued over the citizenship requirement, and a federal court has blocked that from going into effect. But again, this is another example of where federal government is trying to step into election administration, you know, which is a role of government that traditionally and under our Constitution has been the purview of local and state governments.
Before we go, Carter, I wanted to ask you what you'll be looking at in the year ahead, but it sounds like that's what you'll be looking at. You'll be looking at how do these lawsuits go and what comes next. So maybe for a wrap up instead, could you just tell me how you're feeling in this moment as somebody that follows elections? How are you feeling about elections in Pennsylvania in particular, or and just our electoral process overall?
Well, I guess I would say I'm here mostly just to report on what's happening. But my thought is, you know, I think election administrators are going to continue to do the job and do it well, you know, barring the occasional human error that pops up. I don't have any concerns about that. You know, I'm not concerned that election administrators are going to have to start helping steal elections, certainly. I think the thing I continue to be concerned about is, like I mentioned, is just the public perception of election administration and how much to trust it. Because I think, you know, when that public trust no longer exists, and really, you know, this is a process that I have seen almost every single step of the election administration process, which is a privilege I have from my job and something that most citizens don't get to see, even though, you know, most election administrators I know are happy to welcome the public in and show them their operation. But most people just don't see that. And I think as a human, it's hard to trust the process you're not really seeing. And I worry more about if that trust deteriorates, you know, what happens then.
As the younger folks say, same. I'm very much the same on that. Carter Walker, I want to thank you so much for the good work that you do and the fact that you take so much time to break it all down, explain it for me and the listener. It means so much to us. And I wish you all the best in the new year.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. And happy new year to you as well.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring deli sandwiches, gourmet specials, and catering. TheNeversinkGeneralStore.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On the next On the Media, 2025, a year like no one's ever seen before. And the war against the press got faster and furiouser.
We welcome independent journalists, podcasters, social media influencers, and content creators to apply for credentials to cover this White House.
A roller coaster ride on the next On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. A winter storm warning is in effect for our listening area until noon Saturday. Heavy snow is expected with total accumulations between 5 and 10 inches. Snow develops this afternoon with the heaviest snowfall late this afternoon through this evening, before tapering off early Saturday. Travel could be very difficult this evening. If you must travel, be prepared and keep an emergency kit in your vehicle, including a flashlight, food, and water. For the latest road conditions, call 511.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6, right after All Things Considered. The local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.